Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You have no idea. That's what one of my friends told me many years ago when yet another one of his friends had been diagnosed with AIDS. You have no idea, he said, what it's like to watch everyone you love die all around you. I have to admit he was right, because back then I didn't understand. But in the early 80s, those were also the earliest days of the AIDS epidemic, and the virus was still silently sweeping through communities that were largely out of the mainstream. Then, in 1986, the Boston AIDS Walk changed all that. On the first Sunday of every June since, the solemn walk has continued, part fundraiser, part call to action, and part memorial.
You came because of funerals and friends. You came because of babies and mothers. You came because of an epidemic once considered for others. But we now realize we need a global intervention. You could have been anywhere in the world this morning. But you came here, fired up, ready to move and commemorate the fight against HIV and AIDS. So I thank you.
In 1986, 400 people participated, raising $325,000. Now, 25 years later, close to 300,000 Bostonians have joined in the walk, raising over $35 million for the AIDS Action Committee. The walk also raised AIDS awareness. However, a quarter century later, the once silent epidemic has dropped out of public consciousness again and is quietly attacking different Boston communities, African Americans, Latinos, and actually once again, young gay men. So, were you at the first Boston AIDS Walk? And 25 years later, should greater awareness and action be raised in different communities? And if so, how? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now in the studio is Rebecca Haig. She's president and CEO of the AIDS Action Committee of Massachusetts. Rebecca Haig, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, and thanks for covering this really important topic.
Well, we're very happy to. And also with us is Gary Bailey. He's associate professor of social work at Simmons College, and he's being honored by the AIDS Action Committee for his work on AIDS prevention, particularly amongst gay African Americans. Gary Bailey, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
And with us as well is Wilfred Labiosa. He's project director for Casa Esperanza, a substance abuse and HIV AIDS prevention program in Roxbury. Wilfred Labiosa, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for the invite.
Well, Rebecca Haig, let me start with you. As we said, the Sunday's walk will be the 25th here in Boston. But back in the early days, that first one in 1986, it was a different time, of course, a generation ago, and many gay men, lesbians, those who were in that community were still largely closeted, and coming out to actually participate in this walk was a major personal event for them as well. So was it hard to get folks to come out for that first walk?
Well, in some ways it was hard, and in some ways people felt compelled. As you started the show, they had lost many friends. There were many folks living with HIV, but you're absolutely right. It was a time of huge stigma. Trying to get corporate sponsors was impossible. There was a major shoe company that we went after for the major sponsor. They were coming out with a new walking shoe. They wouldn't accept the proposal. They wouldn't even sell us the shoes. Oh. They basically didn't want anything to do with the walk. And then Lotus stepped up, and they were just great. But we were really fearful that people might, there might be protesters, that there would be some struggles along the way. It was very peaceful. And I think part of it was people were afraid to come, because mm-hmm. that was still when people were afraid if they touched somebody, they might get AIDS.
But Gary Bailey, in those early days, nevertheless, there was this sense of urgency because being diagnosed as being HIV positive was a death sentence then.
It was a death sentence, but also it was a time when people were called to action to also step up to be friends and family. And so out of something as challenging and frightening as AIDS was, and it was AIDS then, and we didn't talk about HIV, and we talked about people dying with AIDS, that there was, out of it came the creation of a sense of community, out of that urgency came a community.
So the walk itself kind of became an organizing force?
The walk became an organizing force. It also became a way in which you could, in the light of day, let people know that you cared and that you deserved to be cared about, that you were part of a society and of a community.
Well, Rebecca Hague, so on the flip side of that, for people outside the community who witnessed the walk in those early years, did it produce, I guess the answer is yes, but how quickly did it produce awareness that A, the community existed, and B, that it was suffering greatly with this disease, and C, something needed to be done about it?
Well, I think awareness, it really blossomed after that.
Yes.
I think we needed to get over the barrier, demonstrate to people, and Gary so aptly said that we deserve to be cared about, and more importantly, there was something you could do. This was about individual action. That's why the theme this year of honor, hope, action, love is so important, because people did all those things and they needed to act in order to show that they were going to do something. So they raised money, they marched, they demanded public policy changes.
So that's those are very concrete outcomes of those first walks. I mean, community building is of course very important, but there was an actual impact positively in terms of how AIDS was being treated and identified and prevented in the community.
In some ways, we came out of the closet.
We did.
We came out of the closet and we said, we're here and you have to contend with us. And by the way, this is something that you need to be part of, because it could affect every part of this community.
Let's take a quick call here. Angela's calling from Brookline. Welcome to Radio Boston, Angela.
Hi.
What's your thought today?
Well, I just wanted to say that I'm proud to say that, and I'm going to get emotional now, but I was a part of the first walk. And it was a small group. I just heard your numbers, that it was only 400, but I didn't know how many people that were there. But it was a small group. It was a small walk. I think we just kept it along the Charles River and started at the Hatch Hill and ended at the Hatch Hill. And it was just basically gay men and a few of their friends. And I'm just proud that, you know, I was a part of that first walk.
Angela,
5 years ago.
Angela, if you could tell us what was your thinking at the time that made you decide you wanted to do this, especially since it was the first time anything like this had ever happened in Boston.
Well, you know, I was young and I didn't think about that. I just thought, I mean, these were my friends, and you know, I didn't give it. I mean, it was the right thing to do. I mean, people were dying and something needed to be done.
Mm-hmm. And Angela, if I can also ask, I mean, now that it's been 25 years and you were there at the first walk, do you feel like the work of building AIDS awareness, of the things that that first walk wanted to accomplish, that is it done? Or is there a renewed need for people to be participating in these kind of things?
Well, I think as long as you know, AIDS is still in our communities and still part of the world, not just here in Boston, but the world, I think we still need to participate and fund and keep at it until, yeah, things, you know, get better.
Are you going to be walking this year?
You know, I don't think I'm going to make it this year, and I really feel bad about it because, yeah, this is the 25th anniversary. But I've always given to AIDS Action Committee, you know, financially. I didn't have
thank
a lot
you.
To give, but I've always supported them over the years.
Well, Angela, thank you so much for your call and for also having been there that first time 25 years ago. And actually, she helps us sort of fast forward to where we are today in terms of HIV and AIDS infection in Massachusetts. And Wilfred Labioso, if I can turn to you for, you know, I'm reading here that basically more than half of people infected with HIV in Massachusetts now are in minority communities. They're African-American or Latino.
That is correct. And within the Latino community is really the fourth leading cause of death between women and men.
Fourth leading cause.
Yes. And so it is an epidemic within the Latino community, also within the Latino GLBT community, as well as the youth. Latino youth are still getting infected because of practicing unsafe sex, different behaviors. But predominantly within Latinos, it is because of heterosexual contact or because of intravenous drug use. And so that is why it is so important to continue the education that the AIDS Action Committee and other organizations like myself, Casa Esperanza, does to educate the community at large, because it is still so prevalent within our communities.
Well, you mentioned, for example, intravenous drug use. And if I understand correctly, in some communities like Springfield and Holyoke, where there's a large Latino community, that, for example, in Holyoke, 38 to almost 40% of new infections come through needle sharing. That was in the 2003-2005
That is correct.
Time frame. So what is it? I mean, first of all, is lack of awareness a problem in minority communities now? Or do they know and it's just they're not getting the kind of assistance that maybe other communities got 10 years ago?
Well, there's wide array of topics there to address complex topics that you said. First of all, needle exchange programs are very limited in across our state. They're very few and far in between. Second of all, the issue about education, schools still are not educating our youth, still are not in our churches that Latinos do frequent, do not educate about this epidemic, and do not educate that and really realize that the drug substance abuse is a major issue within Latinos and African American communities. So it is important for us that, you know, the No Drug campaign, let's not go there, because that has been really in our minds, but really it's not educating the people about where, why not begin. And that is important, is not to begin. There's so much relapsing among our communities that we really need to educate the community the importance of not starting. And really not just no drugs, it's more about behaviors that we need to address.
And if I could just add to that, what happens right now with HIV and AIDS is we are at the vortex of social justice issues.
Exactly.
That it's about stigma and discrimination. Yes. It's about sexism. It's about homophobia. Mm-hmm. We are a country that does not want to talk about sex and drugs, and we're killing our children because we don't want to give them the facts and figures they need to protect themselves.
We don't want to address the issue. And so it is also it's important that we are so afraid of getting tested. And so more and more Latinos and African-American men are getting tested when they're already have an AIDS diagnosis. And we know that if we it is prevented, and that if we know that if we capped it on time, they can live long, healthy lives. That's why it's so important to promote HIV testing among youth, among people who are at risk, heterosexual women, and really men who may men seeking men and or also people in different parameters around the state. It's not just a city problem. It is a state problem. It's a nation problem.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, I mean, many people don't even know they're infected. The Department of Public Health in Massachusetts says some more than 20%
that is correct.
Of current people who have HIV don't even know it.
Well, and it's also, as Rebecca and Wilfred were saying, you know, I would also see racism as being the mortar that holds so much of this together. It is the permanent underclass exclusion for so many people from traditional pathways to being able to take better care of themselves. If we think about where we have been in this country about the debate about health care reform and what it means to have a primary care physician, to be able to develop a relationship with a health center or a nurse practitioner, to be able to understand that there is something that can be done and to know that by being aware of your status, you can save your own life and the lives of others.
Gary Bailey, let me ask you about that in particular, because what about within responsibilities within the community, for example? I mean, because we've heard that for, correct me if I'm wrong, please hear, but that within the African American community, there's a resistance to talking about the very fact that there are men who sleep with men, or they just don't want to talk about it, and then those men go on to infect women. I mean, black women get infected with HIV at rates that's much higher than anybody else.
Interesting statistic, and I would never presume to say that I speak for an entire community. But what I am able to do is to say that there are more than enough examples of people who, because of the stigma, the ways in which we and the way in which the world, and I will not say that the African-American community is more homophobic than others, but indeed that we live in a world where homophobia and heterosexism exist and are rampant, that it makes it very hard for people who live in the margins and on the margins to think about being different, and for families to think about their sons and daughters being different.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much rigid gender roles, you know, expected within the Latino community, African-American community, and the Asian community, that it is so hard for youth and even young adults to really come out of that rigid sexual roles that we're taught in school. You know, within the Latino community, it's almost machismo. You know, the man has its role. Yeah. And so when you experience sex with another man, but you're married, how can you talk about sexuality when it's so much stigmatized, when you need to fit that role that your family has told you that you need to fit in?
Rebecca Haig, let me ask you, the other issue that was raised here, and one which may cut across all of these communities, is that the poor are overwhelmingly, disproportionately affected. I mean, again, from the Department of Public Health, I read that the average family income of a person with HIV and AIDS, or AIDS in Massachusetts, back in 2007, at least from this data, was just $7,500 a year. These are people who need community services to stay healthy.
Oh, absolutely. We serve at AIDS Action Committee 2,500 people per year with services. We reach thousands of others with prevention. The average family income for our folks is about $9,000 a year. That's probably updated from that figure. But who can live on $9,000 a year? The other thing I just need to add to that last discussion is that AIDS is the number one cause of death for African-American women in the United States, aged 35 to 44. The second cause of death for African-American women, 45 to 54. The biggest risk factor for African-American women, being in a loving, caring relationship. Mm-hmm. So
it, a risk factor.
Yes. I don't know why there isn't more outrage, and I just want to encourage people. This is why we're walking. Come to the AIDS Walk on Sunday. Give money, www.aac.org. You can make a difference.
We have just a couple minutes left here. I want to ask all of you briefly this question that's been kind of in my mind all week long. 25 years ago, people started paying attention because this epidemic was really hitting a community, as we mentioned earlier, that was not in the mainstream. Then we went through this period in the 90s where people in the mainstream were paying attention. We had the Ryan Whites of the world. We had Massachusetts being a leader in funding for AIDS education, outreach, medication, et cetera. Death rates went down dramatically. But now it seems like that seesaw has tipped to the other side. And because the epidemic is once again attacking communities that may not be in the political mainstream, this battle is beginning all over again. Are any of you actually frustrated that a generation has passed and we seem to be starting all over again in some ways?
A little frustrated, but mostly hopeful. And that we have to put the hope back in it. Yes. We can end this epidemic in our lifetime.
We can.
We're starting a new chapter with a lot of hope. And I think there's a lot of us professionals who are trained to really work with people in the grassroots level to really bring back AIDS to the mainstream and to really bring it to the minds of the people who will be most affected, which are those people who are migrating more to Massachusetts, who are living here in our state, who get affected every day.
And there are lessons to be learned from the past that inform our present and challenge us for our future.
Well, that's Gary Bailey. He's Associate Professor of Social Work at Simmons College. AIDS Action is recognizing him for his work on AIDS prevention in the community, particularly amongst gay African Americans. Gary Bailey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We've also joined by Wilfred Labiosa. He's Project Director of Casa Esperanza, a Substance Abuse and Prevention Program in Roxbury. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
And we were also joined today by Rebecca Haig. She's president and CEO of the AIDS Action Committee of Massachusetts. And, of course, the 25th annual Boston AIDS Walk is on Sunday. Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you, and I hope I'll see you there on Sunday.
We'll do our best.